Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to this edition of Vatican Weekend. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, an interview focusing on Chesterton and eugenics, the challenge of our time. That's with the president of the Chesterton Institute at Seton Hall and editor of the Chesterton Review, Father Ian Boyd, one of the speakers at the event, along with his Seton Hall colleague and friend, Professor of History, Dermot Quinn. But first, as always at this time of week, Jill Bevilacqua presents the next in her series, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, a series of reflections and readings focusing on this week's Gospel. The programme begins, as always, with Sean Patrick Lovett reading this week's Gospel for us.
One day when Jesus was praying in seclusion and his disciples were with him, he put the question to them, "Who do the crowd say that I am?" "John the Baptizer," they replied, "and some say Elijah, while others claim that one of the prophets of old has returned from the dead." "But you, who do you say that I am?" he asked them. Peter said in reply, "The Messiah of God." He strictly forbade them to tell this to anyone. "The Son of Man," he said, "must first endure many sufferings, be rejected by the elders, the high priests, and the scribes, and be put to death, and then be raised up on the third day." Jesus said to all, "Whoever wishes to be my follower must deny his very self, take up his cross each day, and follow in my steps. Whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will save it."
Many are the occasions referred to in the Gospels when we're told that Jesus took himself off alone to pray. This time, although he's praying in seclusion, he's not alone. His disciples are with him. Another version reads, "He was praying alone in the presence of his disciples." It might sound confusing, and yet what Luke seems to be telling us is that Jesus and his disciples are in a secluded spot, away from the usual crowds. Jesus has not gone off on his own this time, however, but has taken the disciples with him. We're not told if they are praying too. The evangelists never seem to mention this, though we know they asked Jesus to teach them to pray. Why did Jesus take them with him this time? The answer is surely in the question he puts to them, the second question, "Who do you say that I am?" If we turn to the Gospels of Matthew and Mark, we're given a fuller account of what happened on that occasion. Not only did Peter answer the question by acknowledging the divinity of Christ, but he was promised the keys of the kingdom. For such an event, we can hardly call it an episode, there was very good reason to withdraw to a place where the crowds were unlikely to follow them. Jesus may well have been waiting for a suitable opportunity for some time. Shortly before, Luke writes that they withdrew to a town called Bethsaida, where they could be by themselves, but the crowds got to know, and they went after him. And Luke recounts then the feeding of the 5,000. Bethsaida, which was Peter's hometown, was situated on the north of Lake Galilee, a little to the east of the point where the River Jordan enters the lake. Mark tells of the cure of a blind man at Bethsaida, just before the event we're considering. And both he and Matthew give us a piece of information Luke omits. They tell us where it happens. Writes Mark,
"Jesus and his disciples left for the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way he put this question to his disciples, 'Who do people say I am?'"
Matthew says briefly,
"When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he put this question to his disciples, 'Who do people say the Son of Man is?'"
There's no exact spot we can pinpoint, but it was near or on the way to Caesarea Philippi, the great pagan city some 40 kilometres to the north. If they went all the way, it would have taken them a couple of days at least, following the course of the Jordan, almost to its source in the foothills of Mount Hermon. Or rather, two of its sources, a third comes from Lebanon. It was the summer of the year 29, it seems, July probably, their last summer together. 9 months later, would come the events which would change all their lives forever. As yet, the apostles were blissfully unaware of the future. But Jesus had to begin preparing them. So as on other significant occasions, he took them away to a place where there would be no towns, no crowds, no wrangling scribes and Pharisees, just themselves. The countryside they were now approaching was much wilder than that of their familiar lakeside.
Hard mountain country, with sudden wide vistas into distant valleys and glimpses ahead of hills and volcanic cliffs of black basalt.
So writes a traveller. The road they're travelling now is a frontier road with ahead the mountains of Syria. Dominating the skyline are the massive peaks of Mount Hermon, almost always covered with snow, even in summer, as it was now. The mountain range of Hermon, over 20 miles in length, is a landmark all over Syria and Palestine.
Vine and olive and mulberry trees grow halfway up its slopes, but after 5,000 feet the bare rock piles itself into fantastic ridges, heaped above terrible chasms, the haunt of eagles, wolves and mountain bears.
What sort of impression would this harsh, rugged landscape have made on the little group of men used to such a different kind of countryside? But then they would have seen something else. An amazing vision would have risen up before them. The splendid pagan city of Caesarea Philippi.
The city nestled in a beauty of marble columns and running water among the thick woods of the lowest slopes of Hermon. In all Palestine and Syria, there was no more lovely sight for a city. In the hills at the back was a dark grotto in which one of the sources of the Jordan welled up from the earth to rush, sparkling in the sunlight, through the city to the plain. The Greeks had called the place Paneas, because such grottos were always sacred to the god Pan. Herod the Great had adorned Paneas with a temple to the Emperor Augustus. When Philip the Tetrarch inherited this exquisite spot in the year of Christ's birth, he built there a city which he called Caesarea, in honor of the Emperor Tiberius, adding his own name to distinguish it from the city of Caesarea on the seacoast.
Perhaps, as our traveller notes, of all the adventures this place has suffered, none is stranger than that of its name. When he was there in the 1930s, he found only a tangle of briars and a huddle of mud houses. The name was once more Paneas, but because there is no P in their alphabet, the Arabs had called it Baneas. Baneas it is today. Only times must have changed, for as the guidebook tells us, it is now a major tourist attraction with pleasant surroundings, important remnants of the past and many local amenities. Let's hear H.V. Morton's conclusion, as surrounded by briars and hovels, he imagines the city as Jesus and the apostles saw it.
In Roman times, the city must have been one of the finest in the country. The sound of running water enlivened its streets. Even on the hottest summer day, the pale green, melted snow water went rushing through them into the valley. And today, the tumultuous sources of the Jordan leap out from the roots of Hermon and go singing over the dead body of Caesarea Philippi.
The great city is no more. The place has regained its ancient name. But throughout the centuries there has been one constant presence. Water, the spring of the river Hermon, which issues from the Grotto of Pan, source of the River Jordan, together with a number of small waterfalls. And this is surely what draws the tourists. But there's another element, rock, for all this is on the rock escarpment above the town. And as Jesus and his disciples approached, what they would have seen first would have been Herod's temple, perched high on the rock, which was visible for miles around. And what is one of the sights shown to visitors? A spot above the rock escarpment believed to be where Peter received the keys to the kingdom of heaven. This, of course, we know to be not quite exact, as on that occasion Peter was only promised the keys. But it was then that Jesus said to him, "You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." As far as we know, Jesus and his disciples never visited the glittering city in the foothills of Mount Hermon. Like Tiberias, it was pagan and therefore unclean. But from Matthew's Gospel, we know that they were in the area, and that this was probably the northernmost point they ever reached. The Hermon mountain range marked the northern limit of the conquests of Moses and Joshua, while a little way to the east of today's Banias is Dan. When the Israelite tribe of Dan took the Canaanite city of Laish, they renamed it. And the phrase, from Dan even to Beersheba, described the biblical Israelite territory. Not that this was such a great distance, as our traveller comments.
A man in a good car can breakfast on the ruined hill of Dan under the Lebanons and eat his evening meal beside the wells of Abraham on the desert plain around Beersheba in the south.
And today he could probably even be there by lunchtime. All these details seem to point to one thing, that our Lord chose to go to the extreme limits of the territory of the Old Testament to speak to his disciples of the founding of the New and of what it would entail. The answers given to his first question show how deeply rooted people were in the idea of a returned prophet. Some said he was John the Baptist, who'd been killed by Herod less than 6 months earlier, and the memory of whom would have been fresh in their minds. Others believed he must be Elijah or one of the prophets. Matthew's version also mentions Jeremiah. Perhaps we need to clarify our ideas on what exactly a prophet is or was. Usually we mean the prophets who wrote the prophetic books of the Bible, four of whom are known as the major prophets, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and, yes, Jeremiah. Major because their writings are more extensive. And then there are a dozen or so minor ones. Jeremiah was specially noted for his calls for moral reform and his prophecies of the fall of Jerusalem to Babylon. But he's had rather a bad press because of his Lamentations, which treat of the destruction of the holy city. So that people whom today we call prophets of doom used to be called Jeremiahs for their doleful visions of the future. The only other prophet mentioned by name here is Elijah, who doesn't seem to have written anything. But then a prophet is one who speaks for God as the inspired revealer or interpreter of his will. Or in another definition, a person who utters divinely inspired revelations, which comes to the same thing. But prophets not only write and speak, they act. And Elijah was protagonist of a famous contest on the heights of Mount Carmel, when he brought down fire from heaven and confounded the priests of Baal. He was what we might call an elemental prophet. He predicted a drought, and a drought there was, neither dew nor rain. 3 years later he said, "I hear the sound of rain," and told his servant to go and look out to the sea. And after going 7 times, the man returned, saying, "Now there is a cloud, small as a man's hand, rising from the sea." And before long, we read, "The sky drew dark with cloud and storm, and rain fell in torrents." But surely the most atmospheric of these events was Elijah's encounter with God on Mount Horeb, the same mountain of God where Moses had crouched in a crevice of the rock while Yahweh passed by. Elijah spent the night in that same cave and then was told by God to come out and stand on the mountain.
Then Yahweh himself went by. There came a mighty wind so strong it tore the mountains and shattered the rocks before Yahweh. But Yahweh was not in the wind. After the wind came an earthquake, but Yahweh was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came a fire, but Yahweh was not in the fire. And after the fire there came the sound of a gentle breeze. And when Elijah heard this, he covered his face with his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Then a voice came to him.
That still, small voice, which has been so often quoted, the voice of God. And a biblical scholar writes,
"The phrase, the sound of a gentle breeze, is a translation, following the old versions, of a Hebrew phrase formed in paradoxical manner, kol demama daka, voice of a gentle silence. In this way, through an apparent contradiction, for silence has no voice, the biblical author seeks to express the depth of the divine mystery. Whereas on Carmel, God revealed himself in a powerful way, by fire, here he reveals himself in silence. By this revelation, the prophet Elijah learns that the Lord is close to his faithful not only by means of great prodigies, but also in the everyday quality of human experience, which seems wrapped only in God's silence.
The man who was fed by ravens in the wilderness and who was carried up to heaven in a chariot of fire in the midst of a whirlwind might not seem to have known the everyday quality of human experience. But he was a prophet and must make God known, and his miracles, we're told, anticipated those Jesus worked as proofs of his messianic mission. Elijah is considered the prophet of prophets. He was seen by the apostles at the Transfiguration together with Moses. He was to come again before the Last Judgment. Why, the apostles asked Jesus. To see that everything is once more as it should be, he told them. But he also referred to John the Baptist when he said,
I tell you that Elijah has come already, and they did not recognize him, but treated him as they pleased, and the Son of Man will suffer similarly at their hands.
Here at Caesarea Philippi, a week before the Transfiguration, Jesus is already speaking of his passion and death, but also of his resurrection, though the evangelists do not record a reaction of the apostles to this. Only in Matthew and Mark, Peter's remonstrance, Heaven preserve you, Lord, this must not happen to you, and our Lord's terrible reply, Get behind me, Satan. The last paragraph of today's Gospel seems to include other people, not just the 12. Jesus said to all, we heard. Mark is more specific. He called the people and his disciples to him. The old Vulgate version goes so far as to say, and calling the multitude together with his disciples. Matthew alone writes simply, Then Jesus said to his disciples. So maybe they had left their secluded spot and were out, so to speak, in the open once more. The next great event, the Transfiguration, was to take place within the week. Some believe it may have happened on Mount Hermon, in which case they were almost there. But tradition has always set it on Mount Tabor, which was days away, well down to the southwest of Lake Galilee, in which case they would now turn their backs on the great and glorious city, on Herod's shining temple, on rocks and waterfalls, and retracing their steps, go southwards once more. The words our Lord spoke next suggest that the crowds are forming again, and foreseeing that there will be those who will declare their desire to follow him, he makes it clear immediately that discipleship does not mean an easy life, and he states the conditions.
Whoever wishes to be my follower must deny his very self, take up his cross each day, and follow in my steps.
And those steps were already leading to Jerusalem and the cross.
Jill Bevilacqua will be back again with another in the series, There's More in the Sunday Gospel, than meets the eye at this same time next week. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, Chesterton and Eugenics, the Challenge of Our Time. That was the focus of an international conference exploring this major theme of the great 20th century English journalist and cultural critic Gilbert Keith Chesterton. A conference which took place early June in Malta. The conference was organised by the Chesterton Institute for Faith and Culture at Seton Hall University in West Orange, New Jersey in the United States, and Malta's own Life Network Foundation. Ahead of the conference, the president of the Chesterton Institute at Seton Hall and editor of the Chesterton Review, Father Ian Boyd, one of the speakers at the event, along with his Seton Hall colleague and friend, Professor of History Dermot Quinn, dropped by our studios here at Vatican Radio and spoke to Chris Altieri. Let's listen to what they told him in this conversation, which focused on Chesterton's understanding of the threat of the eugenic movement, which was, it seems, profound, far-sighted and even prophetic. Our first guest today to answer Chris Altieri's question is Professor Dermot Quinn.
You're talking about eugenics. Interesting word. It sounds very nice, doesn't it?
It does sound nice, and it's not nice. And I think that's probably the theme of our conference and the theme, in many ways, of the Chesterton Institute, to try to explore ugly aspect of something which seems to be rather attractive. I mean, eugenics was a hugely popular movement at the beginning of the 20th century. It really dates, I think, from about 1865. In 1865, Francis Galton, who was the cousin of Charles Darwin, published an article in Macmillan magazine, and he talked about the plasticity of human beings, the possibility of creating, as it were, through genetic manipulation, better kinds of human beings. In 1883, he published a book called Influences on Human Fertility, and in that book he actually coined the term eugenics for the first time.
It's worthwhile, though, pausing over that point when you talk about genetic manipulation. In the second half of the 19th century, mm-hmm. we are talking about generation the old-fashioned way.
Absolutely.
Selective breeding.
Exactly.
At this point, Father Ian Boyd chipped in and joined the conversation.
Anthropological point is the important one, and that is treating human beings as though they were higher order animals. And that is the fundamental premise and flaw of the eugenics movement, surely.
Yeah, I think, the distinction that was made then, and the distinction which is continues to be made, is between positive and negative eugenics. Positive eugenics being, so to speak, producing better, healthier babies, and negative eugenics, the elimination of the weak, the infirm, and the otherwise unworthy of life.
Right, but it's also the Chesterton point of treating human beings as though they were dray horses.
Oh, of course, I'm not I'm not defending any
of
kind of
not.
Eugenics, but at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, this was procreation in the usual way.
Right, and the point I want to make, and a number of people have made, was that Chesterton's challenge to the eugenics movement before the First World War was a successful challenge, in the UK at least, because single-handedly, through public lectures and, of course, his writing, Chesterton stopped the eugenics legislation in England. So the legislation introduced, by the way, by a conservative government, Balfour's government, at the beginning of the 20th century, and then revived by a liberal government. It had cross-party support, Labour, Liberal, and Conservative. This Mental Deficiency Act, which was introduced then in 1913, Chesterton challenged it so effectively that practically every bad feature of the bill was removed before it was finally passed. A completely toothless bill, which in the end, all it suggested was that illegitimate children should be brought into into government care. Probably a bad measure too, but no talk about sterilization, no reference to the undefined feeble-minded. All Chesterton's points were effectively accepted by Winston Churchill, Home Secretary at the time, and an enthusiast for eugenics, and, as I say, a popular movement. A eugenics congress just before the bill had 750 delegates, and it was addressed by Balfour and Churchill and all the leading politicians of the day. Chesterton was really confronting a very powerful and entrenched establishment movement, and he did it successfully.
It was a setback, to be sure, to the movement. And the movement itself was not helped also by its enthusiastic embrace by the National Socialists in Germany.
That discredited it
later.
Temporarily, anyway.
The bill that Chesterton opposed was the Feeble-Minded Control Bill.
Yes.
And that made distinctions between different types of human being.
Yes.
And that's the thing that Chesterton was just deeply offended by, as I think any Christian would be, that there are, so to speak, worthy kinds of human life and unworthy kinds of human life. So that the Feeble-Minded Control Bill, which was a private legislation or private proposed piece of legislation, made distinctions between feeble-minded, idiots, moral imbeciles, and so
and
on.
And always the poor, of
and,
course.
Always the poor. Those sets of distinctions, which would then be, so to speak, ratified by law, Chesterton found very offensive, as indeed did his great friend, Father Vincent McNab, who was a Dominican priest and one of the great English Dominicans of the 20th century. Father McNab opposed the bill as well. So as Father says, the resistance to this this eugenics legislation was led by Chesterton and by Father McNab and
Quiller Couch.
Quiller Couch as well. And indeed was successful. Now, it should be said that the Mental Deficiency Act, which was passed in 1913, remained in the statute books until 1959. So, and the question was, I mean, it was a perfectly reasonable question that was being addressed, namely, what do we do with people who can't look after themselves? I mean, this is not an unworthy question, and I mean, it's something that has to be answered. The law has to have some sort of response to the problem of people who are incapable of looking after themselves.
But you would agree, wouldn't you, that the law, bad as it was altered immeasurably for the better by Chesterton's criticism of it.
No question about it. And just to get to Christopher's point, the eugenicist movement was associated, obviously, with National Socialism in the 1930s, and that, in the eyes of British eugenicists, certainly discredited it temporarily. I think the point of our conference in Malta is to draw attention to the fact that eugenics, although discredited in its most egregious forms, has returned, so to speak, by the back door, and we have a new eugenicism, to coin a phrase, which poses every bit as much a challenge in the first years of the 21st century.
More insidiously.
More insidiously. We see that in all sorts of ways across the world.
You know, another point, I think, to be stressed is the prophetic, we're already making that point, I suppose, the prophetic nature of Chesterton. He said of Cobbett, lines that could be applied to Chesterton, he said of Cobbett, he saw what we see, but he saw it when it wasn't there. Chesterton saw all the, as you say, insidious developments mm-hmm. of the eugenics movement, where now you can have a tailor-made child by manipulating the genes. He saw that danger when it wasn't there answered it. So his prophets, of course, speak to their own day, as Chesterton did most effectively, but they also speak to the future. We who've lived to see what eugenics came to be within the Nazi period and what it's come to be in our own day find that Chesterton really is speaking to us even more than he spoke to his own contemporaries.
You were listening there to a programme focusing on Chesterton and eugenics, the challenge of our time, which was the focus of an international conference exploring this major theme earlier this month in Malta. Our guests were the president of the Chesterton Institute at Seton Hall and editor of the Chesterton Review, Father Ian Boyd, and his Seton Hall colleague and friend, Professor of History, Dermot Quinn. Our thanks go to them and, of course, to Chris Altieri. That brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Laudetur Jesus Christus.